Oh, Canada. What the hell is going on here? You were once the shining example of what other countries always dreamed to be. A safe, free, prosperous society that allowed every generation to do better than the last. A nation that welcomed immigrants with open arms, while still upholding the values that made Canada, Canada. But terrible things are happening in the land of maple syrup, with more and more Canadians now realizing that their beloved country is becoming less recognizable by the day. From a devastating housing crisis, to a miserable economy, to increasing rates of crime, to a catastrophic brain drain, to a broken immigration system, to a deadly healthcare program, Canada is clearly heading in the wrong direction and closer than ever to becoming a failed state. Unlike most videos that only scratch the surface of one or two problems, this will be a comprehensive exploration into all of Canada's systemic issues that many around the world will relate to. Ordinary people who are hurting deserve real change to a status quo that has failed them for so long. However, serious change requires serious attention. So to understand what's going on in Canada that is making life a nightmare for millions of Canadians, stick around because this is How to Kill a Nation. The year is 2008. Kids are going to their local Blockbuster to see the latest movies like The Dark Knight, Kung Fu Panda, Iron Man, and WALL-E. Meanwhile, their parents are doing great. A couple years ago, the bank offered them a fantastic loan to buy a first-time home that was well beyond their expectations. Or for other families, a loan for a newer, bigger house than the one they previously had. These families continued to make their mortgage payments until one day, they couldn't. Over the course of 2 years leading up to the crash, millions of Americans defaulted on predatory loans and were forced by the banks to liquidate their homes. But because America was and still is the biggest economy in the world, this subprime mortgage crisis, as it's now called, triggered a wider financial recession that led to the largest global economic crash since the Great Depression. But something really weird happened in Canada. In the words of the greatest Canadian band to ever exist, let's look at this graph. Here we see Canada and America's housing prices starting from 1990, and how it's been moving since, adjusted for inflation, of course. In an ideal world, people are probably fine with essentials like food and shelter rising in price every year, just as long as it moves roughly in line with inflation. Meaning, if the price of homes, groceries, and gas increased 2% this year, that's okay because your wage rose by 2% as well. In this hypothetical situation, that would mean the graph would show both countries' lines staying flat at the 100 level, where the price of housing is growing, but only at the rate of inflation, which keeps the real cost of housing the same. Of course, this obviously didn't happen. And both Canada and the United States saw the cost of shelter increase year by year well beyond inflation. But unlike the US, where real estate fell back to more affordable levels after the recession, the price of Canadian housing never really dropped, and in fact, only continued to go up and up and up. Now don't get me wrong, America's home prices are also way too high right now and should ideally come back down. But imagine living in Canada, where it's this. Among all the countries in the G7, Canada is by far the worst when it comes to housing affordability. To illustrate this issue, let's play a fun game I'll call Guess the Canadian Home. We'll start with contestant number 1, a stunning 4-bedroom, 3-bathroom house with a 2-car garage, a cool kitchen island, a completely open second floor for you to design to your liking, and a nice large balcony to relax and grill some barbecue for just $982,000. Next stop, we have the most gorgeous 5-bed, 6-bath villa built just a few years ago, featuring your very own private pool, a conference room where you can maximize shareholder value, a cool-looking kitchen with flowers, a close-up of the flowers because why not, a backshot of the flowers because why not, and a children's bedroom, all for $1.3 million. And lastly, we have our third house of the day, a magnificent 5-bed, 3-bath duplex, which means you get the privilege of having someone on the other side of your wall hear everything you do. On the inside, we see some gently used floors that just need a bit of scrubbing. Beautiful furniture that can be flexibly rearranged. A room perfectly suitable for living. Incredible lighting. State-of-the-art heating and plumbing. A well-seasoned bathroom with a sample of the house's interior cut open to remind you of its strong structural integrity. A softly dusted basement to keep the kids and rats sheltered. Another room with a big beautiful window to let all the sun in. A second bathroom with four unique wall designs. Five if you include the natural fade from years of moisture eroding the back of the sink. A storage room to fit the ATM you stole last week to afford the monthly mortgage payment for this house. A third bathroom, wow, what a treat, with a portable toilet. And a scenic backyard that may or may not contain a dozen used needles throughout the site. This once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to call everything here your home will cost you just $1.8 million. So, which one is the Canadian home? If you guess contestant number three, you'd be correct. Toronto is where you'll be paying 50 years worth of wages to have this marvelous half of a house. Oh, but come on, Bofang, that's ridiculous. How is anyone supposed to live in this thing without spending $1 million more and years of red tape to completely rebuild it? Yeah, okay, you're right, let's try again. Here's a beautiful four-bedroom place with the cozy ambience of a grandmother's home where she overfeeds you and lets you stay up way longer than you normally should. Final price? $1.2 million. Next house, 5-bed, 3-bath. This would quite literally be the perfect dream home with all the space you would need to raise a large multi-generational family for $1.8 million. Finally, we have a modest 2-bed, 2-bath house with a basic interior that gets the job done. This would have been considered a nice little starter home affordable to really any young boomer who was working a regular job right out of high school supporting their family. But today, it's $2 million USD. And yep, you guessed it, this is the Canadian home in Ottawa, where it's filled with snobby bureaucrats and freezing for 8 months of the year. And keep in mind, I'm not comparing Canada to developing countries that have dirt cheap housing and way lower standards of living. I'm showing you famous cities considered to be some of the world's best places to live, where the rich and successful want to be. Tokyo, Venice, New York. This is literally just a few miles from the Eiffel f***ing Tower. Meanwhile, this is a house in Vancouver, which looks decent enough, until you learn that it's $12 million US. Yes, this old, mediocre home that no one in any normal country would consider special is more expensive than houses in Hong Kong, Dubai, Hawaii, Singapore, and Beverly Hills. Places with way more prestige and way less depressing weather. There should be absolutely zero reason why it's so much more expensive to live in Canada compared to all these other cool places. It's even cheaper to just buy your own private island in the Caribbean or Florida. Oh, and the bonus house included is still in better shape than the one you get in Canada. But Bofang, we're talking about the world's second largest country here. How in the hell is housing so expensive when they clearly have no shortage of living space? Well, you'd be correct if you were asking 200 years ago. In fact, land was so bountiful and cheap back then that for nearly a century, Canada gave any immigrant willing to settle west of Ontario 160 acres for free. But most people aren't farmers anymore. And urbanization means that what you think of as Canada is really just three tiny zones disguised as a country. Because of this, the nation's urban areas are actually some of the densest places in the entire continent, which kind of makes sense when you realize that cold American cities like Chicago and Seattle are still warmer than the warmest parts of Canada like Toronto and Vancouver. However, it's not actually density that causes Canadian housing to be so insanely overpriced. Otherwise, Barcelona, Taipei, Athens, and Bangkok would all be way more expensive. The real reasons are a lot more complicated, although the result is fairly straightforward. More than 1 in 10 Canadians will experience some form of homelessness in their lifetime. And if you want to find anything for less than $500,000 in Canada, you'll either need to cram yourself in a shoebox or accept the fact that you'll be spending at least 3 hours a day commuting for work. Or just live in Winnipeg. And people wonder why no one in the country is having children. Whatever housing problems other countries have, which are themselves awful and requires urgent action, still pales in comparison to the catastrophe in the true north. So it's no surprise the vast majority of Canadians think owning your own home is a luxury. Imagine, something that was assumed as normal to have just a generation ago is today so out of reach for ordinary people that society now considers it a luxury. Canadians may call this country home, but for far too many, Canada is now a home without homes. And it's not just the cost of housing that's killing the nation. This is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the systemic problems this country faces. It would be one thing to only struggle with affording a place to live, but Canadians are also struggling to afford a life to live. Because combine this housing crisis with a broken economy that results in food, gas, and well, everything being so much more expensive compared to other countries, and you have a nation that has one of the highest household debts in the world, with nearly half its citizens struggling to meet day-to-day expenses. But it gets even worse. If you live in a place like California, sure, prices are high and life for many there is painfully unaffordable, but at least Californians get paid Californian wages. Now imagine instead of struggling with California prices on a California wage, we somehow found a country where people are paying for things as if they lived in America's most expensive state, but making less money than America's poorest state. Well, that sick and twisted world is unfortunately reality for millions living in Canada. The home of Hollywood, LA, is known to have some of the most expensive gas in the land of the free. Canada has their own Hollywood in the north, called Vancouver, which is exactly like Hollywood if Hollywood was cold, dark, and rainy most of the year, and so generic of a location that every type of movie possible has used the place as its setting. I'm sorry, but it's just true. Vancouver is the stunt double for every other city in the world. The price of gas up there, after converting loonies to dollars and liters to gallons, is 10 to 20% higher than LA, one of the most expensive cities in the state with the most expensive gas. The BBC conducted an investigation that took a basket of everyday groceries and found that Canada's bill came out to be 33% more expensive than the US and 48% more than the UK. Other reports show that basic staples such as bread, meat, milk, and eggs are all typically more expensive in Canada than down south. The result of this disparity is that about 1 in 5 Canadians today are food insecure. And scurvy, you know, the thing pirates used to get hundreds of years ago? Yeah, that's making a comeback in Canada. Enough where the Canadian Medical Association felt they needed to issue a warning for doctors to be on the lookout for signs of scurvy in their patients. Turns out, the last Saskatchewan pirates are still with us. Perhaps the biggest reason behind these higher prices is the unfortunate fact that Canada has a cartel problem. Not the Breaking Bad type, but the every industry being dominated by a few giant corporations so they don't have incentive to compete type. Imagine you live in Canada. You stop by the Loblaws around the corner to buy some flowers for your anniversary, because if you forgot, it means you don't love her anymore. Next week, you do your big shopping haul at Superstore, where you find some amazing deals like $19 for 4 chicken breasts, $6 for tomato sauce, $20 for cheese, and $8 for chips. A few days later, you go to the nearby Shoppers Drug Mart to receive your prescription that helps you deal with the pain of all these prices. Then the week after, you pick up some more stuff at No Frills to restock on those perishables that just ran out. Throughout this entire time, all the places you went to shop at were just one large corporation called Loblaw Companies Ltd., controlled by a powerful billionaire dynasty known as the Weston family. You see, Canadians are given the illusion that they have plenty of options to choose from, but in reality, five conglomerates control the vast majority of Canada's entire retail market, which creates a perfect environment for them to start colluding together to raise their prices. Now that might sound like a crazy conspiracy theory, until you learn they were caught doing exactly that with bread, which is estimated to have cost the average household roughly $400 from 2001 to 2015. But don't worry, justice was served, with most of them still dragging their feet in court to this day. And meanwhile, Loblaws offered people a $25 gift card to apologize for their fraud. Hey, Roblaws here. We'll be nice and give a fraction of that money we stole from you over the years. And to add insult to injury, we're not letting you use it on anything other than buying more of our stuff. And keep in mind, they had the audacity to defraud people with something as common and blatantly out in the open as bread, and it still took them over a decade to get caught. So if you somehow think they're only colluding over baked goods and not messing with other products that are much harder to investigate, boy do I have a house in Vancouver to sell you. And I wish it was just the food, but cartels also control Canada's banks, telecommunications, airlines, and so many other industries, which result in Canadians paying higher prices for everything from mortgages to the internet to traveling. Strangely enough, Canada has a problem with both overregulation and underregulation. Overregulation in the sense that the government makes it nearly impossible for companies abroad to compete in Canada, which would actually create an incentive for Canadian firms to make better quality products at a more affordable price. And underregulation in the sense that authorities don't seem to care if industries are consisting of fewer and fewer players as a result of mergers and acquisitions. In fact, just recently, Canada's biggest financial institution acquired the 7th largest in the country. And when it comes to your phone and internet, Canada's number 3 just merged with number 4 as well. In summary, the government seems to be totally fine with large corporations gobbling up all the smaller players to then jack up their prices and refuse to improve their product, just as long as it's a company from Canada. Okay, so we've established that for much of life's necessities, Canadians are often paying more than their neighbors down south. But surely they must be making at least as much as Americans to compensate for these ridiculous prices, right? The truth is, Canada's real GDP per capita has stagnated for nearly a decade, with the country's standard of living on track for its worst decline in 40 years. Median earnings in all 10 Canadian provinces are now lower than all 50 US states, which means they would be the 51st to 60th poorest states in the Union if Trump's wish actually came true. The Economist reached a similar conclusion. Average wages in America's poorest state, Mississippi, are higher than the average in Canada. Even the Fed's own data admits to this tragedy. According to the latest numbers from both governments, the median annual income in the United States is $48,000. In Canada, it's $43,000. You might be thinking, $5,000, that's not as bad as you're making this sound, Bofang. Until you realize, that Canadian number is in Canadian currency, which means it's actually $30,000. Even after factoring in nerdy econ stuff like purchasing power parity, the disparity in standard of living between the two countries is at its worst point in decades. This is, unfortunately, the dark reality of living in Canada. Millions of Canadians paying California prices on a Mississippi wage. As a result of this harsh economic reality, Canada is facing record amounts of its best and brightest leaving her for a better life abroad. Now you might be thinking it's mostly just actors and musicians, right? Obviously, they'll have to come to America to make it big. And true, for decades, Canada has always had its fair share of talent go south, particularly in the arts and entertainment field. But now, it's more than just movie stars. It's engineers, athletes, entrepreneurs, influencers, scientists, the media. It's even America's politicians. At every level of society, this international cabal of poutine-eating, milkbag-drinking Canadians who hide their stench of maple syrup have infiltrated and taken over prominent roles in the American public. Hell, for all you know, even I could be one of them. But there's an easy explanation for this great Canadian conspiracy. The brain drain starts as early as high school, when talented, aspirational kids across the country apply for coveted spots in America's most prestigious institutions. For those of you proud of your Canadian colleges, sorry, but you don't even come close to these academic giants who are busy taking thousands of Canada's brightest students every year, many of whom end up choosing to stay in the US instead of going back. Part of this problem is an expected result of larger neighbors attracting talent, which is as natural as the laws of gravity. But a lot of this brain drain is self-inflicted, coming from years of policies that make the environment for young, aspirational, talented Canadians unnecessarily difficult. There's perhaps no better way to explain this issue than to look at the depressing state of Canada's national pastime, ice hockey. The only sport where part of the game is to let its players beat the absolute shit out of each other. For those outside North America, the big four major sports leagues consist of the NFL, the NBA, MLB, and lastly, the National Hockey League, often overshadowed and forgotten by its three bigger brothers. What's so depressing for hockey fans in Canada is the fact that the Stanley Cup, the NHL's version of the Super Bowl, hasn't been won by a single Canadian team in over 30 straight years. Here's just how long ago 1993 was. Most baby boomers were still in their 20s and 30s. DVDs weren't even invented yet. George Bush was still president at the start of the year. No, the original George Bush. The Dallas Cowboys were actually a good team.
You need to leave!
If we were to start at a baseline assumption that Canada and the US are both about as good at playing hockey, the odds of a Canadian team failing to win a single Stanley Cup since 1993 is roughly 1 in 2,500. So it's obviously not all because of bad luck. If it was, you had a better chance of being born with an extra limb than seeing this 30-plus year drought. But it isn't because people in Canada suck at hockey either. In fact, there isn't a single American team without at least a few Canadians in their roster. However, that is actually part of the answer here. Because every season, numerous Canadians of the highest caliber jump the border to skate in the US and deliver victories for American teams. Top players considered to be the greatest of all time move down south for better opportunities, more favorable tax rates, and the fact that the good old US of A is just a better place for those who have the talent and work ethic to succeed. Furthermore, NHL teams in Canada don't actually need to be good to survive, unlike their American counterparts. Let me explain. In the US, if your local hockey team sucks and consistently loses over and over again, most people are gonna think twice about going to their games, buying their merch, and maybe even watching all together, and instead choose to support their city's basketball, football, or baseball team. But in Canada, if the Calgary Flames can't even make it to a single final in over 20 years, what are their fans gonna do? Stop watching and start cheering for Calgary's NFL team? How about their NBA team? MLB? Besides Toronto, every other city in the country is stuck with supporting their hockey team, which means stadiums will always be filled, merch will always be sold, and eyeballs will always be on the screen, no matter how dog shit they are. Hockey holds a near monopoly in the world of Canadian sport, and every team up there is essentially an oligarch for each region, pocketing the guaranteed income without ever having incentive to push themselves to the limit. Something any team in any sport needs in order to actually win a major league championship. Look, I'm sure every player wants to win regardless of nationality, but if an organization knows that the money is coming in regardless of how poorly they perform, complacency and stagnation become inevitable. Canada's horrendous record in the NHL is just a small but insightful example that serves as a perfect microcosm of the country's catastrophic brain drain. The financial hurdles that incentivize the very best to take their skills and intelligence abroad. The oligopolistic tendencies of so many industries resulting in a lack of pressure for organizations to do better. This issue is grossly underreported since it's not a disaster we can observe within a day, a month, or even a year. Rather, it is a slow-moving, yet fatal problem that can destroy nations if left unanswered. So if you're a top programmer, why use ChatGPT in Toronto when you can do the same in Silicon Valley and triple your income? If you're a gifted kid looking for the best education, why go to the Ivy program when you can study at an actual Ivy program? If you're a brilliant actor, why be limited to Hollywood North when you can make a name for yourself in the real Hollywood? If you're a hardcore finance bro, why overwork to death on Bay Street when you can do the same on Wall Street for twice the comp? Ask yourself this, what are the long-term effects of a society that constantly pushes out its top-performing, most aspirational people to other countries? Well, we already see its result in the National Hockey League, and other industries aren't looking too great either. So maybe if smart, hardworking, talented Canadians have more incentive to stay, and NHL owners, coaches, and even players start having the mentality of, hey, if we don't perform this year, our team could end up going bankrupt. Maybe, just maybe, will there be a day when the Stanley Cup finally comes home to Canada. As you've probably figured out by now, yes, I am Canadian. So everything I've talked about here has not only been researched, but also informed by my personal experience with having to keep up with soaring rent, groceries, and everything else going on in Canada. When YouTube isn't demonetizing my content, I'm humbled and grateful if I'm making minimum wage creating these videos. Though truthfully, it's becoming impossible to survive relying on ad revenue alone. There's a reason why most creators just pump out easy slop for the masses. It takes so much less time and effort, and the reward from this platform platform is often the same, if not better. So if you're enjoying my content and are able to help me make more videos like this, please consider supporting me on Patreon or YouTube. I seriously cannot do this without your backing. Also, if you think these issues I'm bringing up deserve more attention, please like the video and subscribe so the algorithm will show this to more people. Thank you. Although the choice to leave Canada is just like owning a home, a luxury usually only the privileged can enjoy. But how are ordinary folks faring in the Great White North? We know their economic security is getting worse, however, what about their personal security? Is Canada at least becoming a safer place for regular people just trying to make ends meet?
My 5-year-old daughter opens her door, and she comes out of her room in her nightgown, just like rubbing her eyes, and this guy takes the gun off of me. Puts the gun right up to her head.
They started slicing my arms.
Guns treated like toys and lives treated as afterthoughts.
This brazen carjacking at a Newmarket gas station while the victim was still pumping it with gas.
She had been released from custody after a bail hearing less than an hour before the incident occurred.
That's after police said four of those arrested for the recent robbery of Walter Morrow were out on their disorders. Just 2 days later, another slash and grab.
The individuals committing these crimes are violent and are not deterred by the thoughts. Being arrested.
The alleged thief drives right at the police officer.
This terrifying scene playing out as his wife and kids lock themselves in the bathroom.
From over 3,000 a year between 2014 and 2017, exploding to more than 12,000 cases last year. And residential deaths have risen right on pace with others like carjackings during that same period.
The officers were confronted by as many as 10 suspects. This wild dash cam video shows them attempting to evade police.
88% increase in home invasions over the past year.
According to
Police say one of the suspects was on probation, and another had been released after a separate offense.
Some people shrug away concerns about rising crime, understandably assuming it's just the media sensationalizing events to make things appear worse, believing that crime is actually decreasing. But at least in Canada, this couldn't be further from the truth. According to the government's own data, in the past 10 years, overall crime across the country increased by over 20%, and violent crime is up 40%, at its highest level today since 2006. The fundamental issue is that throughout Canada, a small number of mostly troubled young men are committing crimes, getting arrested, and then being released in little to no time, thus being responsible for a disproportionate amount of crime that terrorizes everyone else in society, often harming or even killing innocent people who were already struggling to begin with. The province of British Columbia published data proving exactly this reality. In Vancouver, just 40 people were responsible for over 6,000 police contacts, with each prolific offender averaging 54 convictions. That's a few dozen people being responsible for over 2,000 convicted crimes. And remember, we're talking about convictions, which represent only a fraction of criminal charges pressed, which represent only a fraction of crimes reported, which represent only a fraction of crimes actually committed. So in reality, the amount of misery and violence these 40 people are responsible for is exponentially more than just the number of convictions on their record. And this report, along with others, show the exact same thing happening across every other city they analyzed, revealing just how crazy Canada has become. Here's a real-life example of what I mean. On Sunday, a man tried to steal someone's car while they were still in it, got arrested and charged with attempted vehicle theft, and was immediately released. Huh. He must have thought, that was stupidly easy. So on Monday, the very next day, he assaulted a woman, stole her Tesla, crashed that Tesla into two more occupied cars, and then tried to steal another vehicle as he was running away. The police did their job as usual, arresting him for the second time in a row and charging him with multiple offenses. Then he was released that very day, again. At this point, he's thinking, boy, is it a wonderful time to be a criminal in Canada. They're absolutely allergic to stopping me. So, 24 hours later on Tuesday, he broke into someone's home while they were still there and robbed them. Now, if you think the legal system finally did something reasonable after 3 straight days of committing crimes, you clearly don't understand this country, because he was released on bail yet again. It's now just as easy to get away with Grand Theft Auto in Canada as it is in Grand Theft Auto. Grand Theft Auto. And this isn't just one fringe case. There are so many more examples that it would take forever to even go through half of them, ranging from people constantly getting caught and let go so they can continue robbing random citizens, to criminals with dozens of violent convictions being freed so they can go on a murder spree in their local communities. A man stepped out of his home as he was calling his fiance and was beaten and brutally stabbed multiple times, inches from certain death. Police investigators later informed the victim that it would take years for the perpetrator to be brought to trial. And even if it went to trial, he almost certainly won't get any jail time, just like many other lovely people. Which means someone who knows where you live because he saw you step out of your home, knows your face because he was busy stabbing you to death, and knows your name because his horrific crime actually made the news this time, is allowed to walk free, stressing you out for the rest of your life since he could come back any day to finish the job. That's fair. At the same time doctors in the hospital were working hard to save an innocent man's life, the attacker was let go. That's Canada for you. A country where the criminal gets released before the victim. To be clear, the solution isn't to just become a totalitarian police state, nor is it to make the same errors other countries make, where far too many are locked up for things that didn't harm anyone, while not nearly enough funding is provided for mental health services and treatment for addiction. But surely we can find something between jailing people for having weed and getting zero prison time for stabbing an elderly man to death, or dismembering your grandchild's mother and burning her body to hide the evidence, or driving through a residential school march and hitting four people with your pickup truck. Oh, sorry, there actually was a punishment for that last guy who was yelling racial slurs and screaming that he didn't care if he ran over children. He can't drive for a year. Also, surely there's a solution where we don't have to allow dangerous men who have violent criminal histories be released on bail just so they can kill more innocent people. The definition of insanity is someone doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. The definition of Canadian insanity is allowing someone to do the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. I'm sorry, but if the police already arrested someone 10, 20, 54 times, but cruel, elitist, morally corrupt judges continue to allow the same few people make life miserable and unsafe for everyone else, Canada has gone criminally insane. Much of the insanity covered thus far is unfortunately exacerbated by one particular policy that's been rather controversial. Canada's broken immigration system. From the very moment European settlers arrived on indigenous soil, the continent of North America has always been a land of immigrants. We'll skip over the first half of history when explicit policies were made to exclude certain races from being able to immigrate, with perhaps the most notable example being when they forced Chinese people to pay a head tax for decades, and then just outright banned them from immigrating at all. It wasn't until 1976 when Canada introduced a points-based system that focused on the merit of each potential immigrant, assessing factors like their education, age, skills, language proficiency, you know, things that kinda matter. Unsurprisingly, this new framework resulted in decades of a consistent yet controlled stream of young, smart, talented people from all corners of the world contributing to Canada and assimilating in society. Up until recently, Canadians have been more or less satisfied, and often even proud of the fact that they were able to be a country which welcomed newcomers while also ensuring those already there were prospering too. But here's where Canada's problem started. Because at the same time the country was doing so wonderfully for its permanent immigrants, they also introduced a worker program that brought in high-skilled people to temporarily fill certain holes in the labor market. This initially made sense, and there wasn't even a need for the government to have a limit on the program since these professionals were only required on a case-by-case basis. But to keep a long and overly complicated story short, this original, well-meaning goal of carefully allowing a limited number of specialized workers to fill in genuine gaps across the economy slowly morphed into a mess of different programs riddled with loopholes corporations are exploiting to create a permanent pool of cheap, unskilled labor that's disrupting virtually every major industry and fundamentally changing the entire economy. Now, for the temporary workers, this is great. An opportunity to be in a country where even working at Tim Hortons can pay more than some of the most prestigious jobs back home. And for employers, it's even better. You no longer have to deal with hiring Canadians who are used to silly things like a living wage, or safety protocols, or workers' rights. You can push these foreigners around all you want, because what are they gonna do? Complain and risk getting sent back? And most importantly, for the government that allows all this to happen, the campaign checks will keep rolling in, because corporate backers love having a near unlimited supply of cheap labor they can exploit. Oh, and bonus points for being able to call anyone opposed to this racist. To be clear, you shouldn't be blaming the immigrants. They're not the ones who created Canada's policies, and the nation's housing, cost of living, and overall economy aren't failing because of them either. But immigration, permanent or temporary, when done wrong, adds another layer of stress to these areas that make existing issues worse. Yet bad policies can still survive as long as there's benefactors to the status quo. It benefits the immigrants because they can make more money than they did back home. It benefits the corporations because they have a never-ending stream of labor to take advantage of. And it benefits the government because they can continue being funded by lobbyists while also claiming their virtuousness. The only problem is, it doesn't seem to particularly benefit those in the country who are least economically secure, who have the least representation in society, and who have nowhere to go to voice their unheard cry for help. Many of these Canadians, who formed the backbone of the nation, who used to be proud of sharing this land with immigrants, are now saying, yes, this land was made for you and me, but to a degree. Despite Canada being known as a land for all to live, not all who live there wish to do so. Literally. Euthanasia is the medical practice of intentionally ending life to eliminate suffering. In recent years, several countries have begun to legalize the procedure, and the subject is being debated by many others. Now, it's quite easy to see a reason for some form of euthanasia to exist. Imagine Grandpa Joe being 93 years old with stage 4 lung cancer that spread to the rest of his body. The doctor estimates that even with all the treatments available, he still only has about 6 more months to live. At this point, every single day for Joe is a painful, living nightmare, and he doesn't want to spend his last moments dying in horrific agony. Most people here would agree that, assuming Grandpa Joe has capacity, he should be able to tell his doctor, "Hey, I've experienced this life for long enough and know what's ahead of me, and for that reason, I'm out." However, Canada takes things a step further. You see, their euthanasia program, known as Medical Assistance in Dying or MAID for short, was first introduced in 2016 and, much like Canada's immigration system, has concerningly expanded over the years. At first, MAID was only provided to those with enduring and intolerable suffering, whose death was reasonably foreseeable. In plain English, that's people who were physically suffering and dying soon. But in 2021, Canada passed Bill C7, expanding MAID to allow people who did not have a reasonably foreseeable death. Additionally, this controversial bill came with a provision to allow people with mental illness access to the program by 2023, but was postponed twice now as a result of opposition by organizations, doctors, and politicians. Even the United Nations Human Rights Council voiced their concern, criticizing the bill for giving people access to MAID who could have instead received adequate services and proper living conditions which would enable them to have a better quality of life. Testimonials from people's experiences with MAID show a deeply concerning picture about the government's inability to properly administer the program, while also shedding light to the dystopian conditions of a healthcare system and housing environment that millions of Canadians experience every day. For instance, a 51-year-old woman with multiple chemical sensitivity, a condition that affects nearly a million Canadians, desperately tried to find a place to live within her budget that didn't have cigarette smoke and other strong chemicals, begging local, provincial, and even federal officials to help her. No assistance was provided, so after 2 years of being unable to find affordable housing for her condition, she decided to apply for MAID and was promptly approved by the very government that ignored her. Christine Gauthier, an army veteran and former Paralympian, was trying to install a wheelchair ramp in her house for 5 years when Canada's VA suggested MAID as an alternative solution. A few more years later, she spoke out yet again because it still hasn't been installed, pointing out how it's taking longer than 7 years to put a ramp in her home, but if she took their suggestion to be euthanized, she can get approval in just a few weeks. Multiple other veterans have also been offered MAID unprompted when discussing treatment for PTSD. A doctor suggested MAID for a woman's child with cerebral palsy, and when the mother refused, was told she was being selfish. All while the daughter was listening. Someone in Ontario who was about to be homeless was approved for MAID despite explicitly saying, "I don't want to die, but I don't want to be homeless more than I don't want to die." Fortunately, a GoFundMe raised enough money for him to avoid homelessness, and he decided to withdraw his MAID application, which again was approved, like he was literally gonna die. Entrapment is the act of inducing someone to do something they would not have otherwise done. Unfortunately, not only are there no laws against MAID being proposed to patients unprompted, but Canada explicitly allows doctors to suggest euthanasia to people who would have otherwise never even considered leaving this world. It is incredibly disturbing that when people are often at their darkest and most vulnerable point in life, someone is able to go to them without any indication of that person being interested in dying and say, "Hey, here's an answer to all your problems." And if all this wasn't enough for you, the government's committee responsible for working on MAID is now recommending that kids should be able to get euthanized, with their parents consulted where appropriate. Not always consulted, but only when they decide it's appropriate. Also, think about the type of person who feels the need to use the term mature minors when referring to children. Those are the people literally running this country. Now, to be fair, the majority of cases are almost certainly done properly for people with terminal illnesses who probably should have the right to access MAID. But it's clear that even in its current form, without the mental illness expansion, far too many people who are already struggling in life are inappropriately being offered MAID, despite the fact that they had no intention of dying. It's also clear that far too many lives are ending because of society's inability to provide the adequate services and care needed to live a life worth living. My best friend recently chose to leave this world, which is perhaps why I am acutely aware of just how much pain a community feels every time someone is taken too soon. Canada and California began their euthanasia programs in the exact same year, in the exact same month. Both places are English-speaking, multicultural democracies. They have an incredibly similar religious composition. Both are known to hold relatively progressive values. Their populations are basically the same. Based on all this, you'd assume that roughly the same number of people are being euthanized. But no. Canada euthanizes not 10% more, not 20%, but 1,600% more people every year compared to California. Tell me, Canada, is this something to be proud of? The fact that MAID is growing faster than people's incomes? Double-digit increases every single year since the program started. That 1 in 20 Canadian deaths are now due to MAID? That people in Canada are being euthanized more than anywhere else in the world? No. I believe it reflects a deep failure in a country that cannot improve the conditions of its people to ensure something like MAID remains exceptionally rare. A system that is far sicker than the individuals who seek to escape it. But the government is choosing to take the easier and cheaper path. Rather than build an environment where people can thrive, create an ultimate solution where they're made to die. You may come away with the impression that I believe Canada is a fundamentally bad country, but this couldn't be further from the truth. Even before its official founding in 1867, it was Canada that was the promised land and heaven for hundreds of thousands of slaves yearning for freedom, risking their lives to travel north through the Underground Railroad. In the Second World War, it was Canada, despite being an ocean away, who immediately joined to defend against the Axis powers that aggressed upon humanity. And in the decades that followed, it was Canada that became a shining example of a nation able to ensure both the freedom and well-being of its people. So no, for most of its history, Canada has actually been a rather good country. However, like every country, Canada has both its highs and lows. We just so happened to be at a low point, but it wasn't too long ago when things were a lot brighter. In fact, I would argue that most of us can still remember when Canada was a great place to be, when Canadians could be proud in knowing that their country and their lives were getting better, not worse. A time when homes were still affordable, not an impossible luxury. A time when immigration was adding to Canada, not disrupting the lives of those already there. A time when, it's crazy I have to say this, people who served to protect the nation weren't being asked to end their lives by organizations who should know better. And believe it or not, that time when Canada was all this and so much more wasn't too long ago. It's 2010. Canada was selected to host the Winter Olympics. By this point, interest in hosting the Games was falling throughout the world because of increasingly frequent scandals and exorbitant costs plaguing recent countries. Even in Canada, known for its polite and optimistic attitude, a small but loud minority were protesting the decision for the Games to be held in the country, voicing reasonable, familiar anti-Olympic arguments that it'll go out of budget, cause chaos and trouble for the local population, and result in facilities to go abandoned. And when the two-week-long event began, it seemed the pessimists were going to be proven right. The very first day started with a tragically fatal accident during training, casting doubt on the competence of Canadian officials managing the Games. Later that evening, in the opening ceremony, the famous tradition to light the Olympic cauldron went painfully wrong, further embarrassing Canada in front of more than a billion people watching. By the end of the first week, Canada had only won 3 gold medals, a disappointing amount for a host country that is kind of known for its strength in winter sport. But then something magical happened. One by one, Canadian athletes across every competition started winning gold. Figure skating, skiing, bobsleighing, speed skating, snowboarding, curling, so much gold in fact, that on the final day of the Olympics, with ice hockey being the last sport to finish, the world realized that if Team Canada are able to win this final game against Team USA, the country would earn 14 gold medals, achieving an all-time world record for most gold medals won at a Winter Olympics. So on the biggest stage for the most important game in the most Canadian sport, the nation stood tall, determined to prove the world they could emerge victorious against all adversity. Instead of playing for American teams in the NHL, Canada's very best came together to show what could be possible if the country did things right and were able to retain their own homegrown talent. The game started off fantastically for the Canadians, with Jonathan Toews and Corey Perry putting Canada ahead 2-0 against Team USA. The Americans fought back hard, however, with Ryan Kessler scoring an amazing goal, and then with 30 seconds remaining, Zach Parise clinching a miracle shot that now forced this final into sudden death overtime. Every second here can make history, with both teams performing under the greatest of pressure. The world is now on the edge of their seats, watching two remaining countries fight tooth and nail to determine who would be the very best. Then finally, after 7 minutes and 40 seconds of the most intense high-stakes overtime in the entire sport's history, Sidney Crosby, the Canadian Golden Boy, scored what will forever be known as Canada's Golden Goal. And this, my friends, is when I believe Canada shined its brightest. Complete strangers high-fiving, dancing, and hugging their fellow citizens. People joining each other with glowing hearts, singing the national anthem with pride. The streets noisy and crowded, but in true Canadian fashion, still respectful and safe. Oh, and the pessimists were proven wrong. Canada was on budget, an overwhelming majority of Canadians were glad to have hosted the Olympics, and the facilities built for these games continue to be used by the local community to this day. From far and wide, 80% of the entire Canadian population had their eyes glued to the game, making it to this day the most watched event in the country's history. This was a time when all of Canada came together, united, showing the world their very best. When 96% of people surveyed felt proud to be Canadian, numbers you will now only see in North Korea. When the loonie was often more valuable than the US dollar, so you felt like a millionaire buying stuff from abroad. When people and businesses alike still had confidence in the country. When the median rent was $760, so I wouldn't have needed to ask for your support to create more content for you to enjoy. I'm serious, these videos are impossible to continue making without your help. When crime was at its lowest point ever and only continuing to fall. When the Canadian standard of living was rising faster than its peers. This was the true North, strong and free. This is the country I knew and loved. This is the Canada Canadians deserve. Life was far from perfect, and so the solution isn't to go back to the past, but it is to take inspiration of what the country got right and strive toward building building a new golden era, one even better than before. With a people so resilient, generous, and hardworking, and blessed with immense natural resources on a land glorious and free, Canada's potential is limitless. Throughout my entire video, I deliberately chose not to mention a single politician's name, because these issues, regardless of who created them, transcend the petty politics of today. Individuals come and go, but problems don't just leave with them. So if there's one thing I want Canadians to know, it is that this country is in your hands. And if there's one thing I want this country to know, it is that Canadians will fight for you and save you. Oh, Canada. Thank you for watching until the end. I hope my conclusion allowed you to have a renewed sense of optimism for the future. Please like and subscribe if you enjoyed. It really does mean a lot to me. I want to keep making more videos like this, but I don't have a team of people working for me like other YouTubers. Nor is there a corporation funding this channel. All I have is just me, and hopefully your support. If you're able to help me create more content, please consider joining my Patreon or YouTube membership. You'll get cool perks such as having your name shouted out in front of millions of people, just like these wonderful friends of mine, whom I am eternally grateful for. Thank you.